A line from a Pink Floyd song that I remember as the title of the talk. Is there anyone at home? Is there anyone at home? I'm a little bit cautious about keeping on talking about non-self, because I have a feeling that one by one you'll all disappear from the room. And I'll be talking to myself here about non-self. Enough already. But an image comes to mind. And the image is, it's a beautiful time in Klil at the moment. This beautiful season. And one of the gifts of this season is that all the kotzim have amazingly beautiful flowers and a sweet scent. Sira kotzonit. The whole year they're aggressive, unpleasant, they hurt you, and then one season in the year they show their beauty of yellow flowers with a beautiful scent. And what's the beauty of the flower? It comes because of this, the kotzim, and the earth, and the roots, and the rain, none of which are the beauty of the flower. But because of all these things, the flower is beautiful, but without them, the flower cannot be beautiful. So the flower, the beauty of the flower is both because of all the things that are not itself, but it can't do without them. It needs them, but is not them. And it's an image from the... in a way, it's the most important image in Zen Buddhism. Well, Zen Buddhism is based, in a way, on one sutta, which I can't remember which one, and I never found it. But I hear that it's there. I'm sure it's there. When the Buddha held up a flower, and that was his answer to some question or some issue. And there wasn't any language there other than this flower. And the flower was enough. And from there, in some way, the whole of Zen Buddhism kind of traces itself back to this symbol in the early Buddhism, or the Buddha himself, that expressed something so sublime. This flower, for this flower to be beautiful, we need the whole world. But it's not the same as the whole world. But you can't do without it. And here it is. And you can't say this. And you can't explain this. You just have to know this, that this flower is because the whole world is there to make it. So from there, Zen went into very deeply into the whole world of non-conceptual practice. The non-verbal, non-conceptual, non-analytical immediacy of knowing, Zazen, and all the art and the martial art also, all the Aikido and the archery and so on, which is all based on this, on non-concept, non-self, something immediate that pulls everything together in this moment, and it's not me doing it. And from there we get the koan, the Zen koans, which are questions that the mind can't solve. And only when the mind is exhausted and you are exhausted and fed up and want to go home, then it comes. And the mind exhausts itself, collapses, and then the truth comes beyond the mind. And this cuts through the illusion of duality, me and the object, me and the flower, as two things, both existing in the world of themselves, by themselves, in themselves. And doesn't mean to say that Zen is the only way. I think we're doing just as good here with a Theravada inspired, Sutta inspired practice. Tibetans are doing fine. It's there are many ways to understand this. It's not, and even Buddhism doesn't have its own the kind of intellectual property. Shuyot Yotsrim of non-duality, of course. I was reminded of a story, which is quite a famous story, and some of you may know this, but apparently it did actually happen, that a Tibetan Rinpoche and a Zen master were giving a talk at Harvard University, and the Zen master brought an orange and put it up in front of everybody and said to the audience and to the Zen master and to the Tibetan and everybody, "What is this?" And there was absolute silence. And it was a very Zen question based on what I was saying, non-conceptual, direct knowing. "What is this?" The orange held up the orange. "What is this?" It's a few times. Zen masters can be very fierce. Very fierce. And he did again. "What is this?" And then the Tibetan turned to his translator and said something. And the translator explained to the audience, Zen, the Tibetan Rinpoche asks, "Has he never seen an orange before?" And it's just a reminder, actually there's an important, something important in this dialogue, which, this story, which I only now realized or thought about. Firstly, of course, anatta is about selves, but the same thing applies to every single object that we can ever see and know. So the anatta really means there is nothing in and of itself. Doesn't mean to say there is nothing in the world. And we cover that, we talked a lot about that in relation to self. It doesn't mean to say no self exists. It means that we can't define it and enclose it in a package that exists as itself in the world called me. But we can't do that with objects either. And I explained it with this. We can't define this thing as existing in itself, stable, permanent, that everyone in the universe would agree what it is. It's a process. This is a process. And the self is a process, and everything else is a process, and everything is connecting to the other, everything else, like the flower needs everything else to make it flower. But there's something else which is quite not, which I just realized now about the story of the orange. In fact, the story of the orange is also about the relative view and the ultimate view. Because where the Zen master would say, "What is this?" And he's totally right to do that. And it's totally right to him ask this question, saying you cannot define an orange. Also the Tibetan Rinpoche is quite right to say it's an orange. it's quite right for me to say this is a stick for the use of a bell, to ring a bell. It's not a problem. The problem is our belief, not a problem that there are things, apparently things in the world that we need to use. There is apparently an experience of a self. And we need that, and we use it, and we use the stick, and we use the bell, and there's agreement between human beings here that this is a bell, and it's used for this purpose. And that's fine. There's no problem with that at all. But what we should be aware of is that it's still a conventional, convenient agreement of what the world is between us, but not absolute truth. It's not the end of the story. It's an agreement between us. That's no more than that. And so, in our life, I think we need to be, feel the dialogue between relative and absolute or ultimate. Ha-yachasi v'ha-mukhlat. They are in dialogue with each other. And as long as we keep remembering that the relative is just a convention, is just a muskamot, is just what we all agree, that this is a bell, it's fine. It still gives respect to the ultimate or to the mukhlat. Just think about two suttas that you all know. They're neither of them are the traditional Buddhist suttas, but they're probably the most famous suttas that we all know. One is the Heart Sutta, and the other one is the Diamond Sutta. And the Heart Sutta says, form is emptiness, and is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness is form, and is nothing other than form. Form, in the Heart Sutta, is Nama-rupa. Because the Heart Sutta, maybe you don't know, it goes through all the five aggregates. It also says feelings, it also says perceptions, it also says sankharas, it also says consciousness. So it goes through the five aggregates, and each one it says, it's not really there, but it's there. So what we understand from that is that there has to be a dialogue between the relative and the ultimate. That when the right time is to be relative, we can be relative. We can say this is a bell. When the right time to be ultimate, we know that. We are no emptiness. We know about the unfindability of things, that we can't find them. We look at something as a mechanism, eyes, consciousness, perception, aggregates, and we see something. And we know that's a process that happens. But it's not the end of the story. It doesn't tell us, in the end, that these things exist. They are process. We see something, it's a process. It doesn't tell us that it really exists or it is. So we need both views in our life as much as we can. In our daily life, we need both these views, the ultimate and the relative. And they're in discussion together. And the Diamond Sutta says something similar. The Diamond Sutta is a much longer sutta, and it goes through all the capacities of a human being. And it says, like, a thought is not a thought. That's why we call it a thought. A word is not really a word, so that's why we call it a word. A person is not really a person, so that's why we call it a person. A cup, an object is not an object, so we call it an object. And this paradox of living in both worlds. And So, the looking defines what it is we see. It's not there without the looking in it, in the shape that we see it. It's the result of conditions. And because of these conditions, the flower flowers. Because of these conditions, this happens. Because of all kinds of other conditions, that happens. Because of this, then that. And that really defines, on the deepest level, what is the Dharma. The word Dharma, the truth of the Dharma. You can't say then what is reality. There's no way you can say what is reality, because everything is in process of becoming something else, of becoming, of changing, of being something else. There's nothing there that we can hang on to and say, that's reality. And so what the word used for closest that we can get to this word, the reality, is tathāta. Tathāta is a Pali word meaning, actually also Sanskrit word. I believe it's the same word in Sanskrit. And it means kahut, basically in Hebrew, or suchness, or it is like that. That is, or that's it. Something like that doesn't really tell you very much. I like Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, the name of God. It's that. It's the same. It is as it is. Because there's really nothing else you can say, because there's nothing there to be said that you can say. It's all in process. It's all, and I really like the word in the Kabbalah. Well, one of the many, many words. And the Kabbalah is a huge wisdom, but it's very inaccessible. Very hard to get access to it. It's covered by layers of history and explanation and language and so on. But those guys, around Shimon Bar Yochai and his group, pretty well like the Buddha and the early Buddhists, this group, they were in Mazet High. of ecstasy and unlimited. But in the Zohar, and I must say, I must give credit to Rachel about this, my wife, because she's the big expert and I'm a very bad student. I only learn little bits. And then I get fed up, and I say, stop, 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 I can't take any more, because it's big. But the word in the Zohar for tathāta, or suchness, is stima distimin in Aramaic, or hastam shalastam, the ultimate stam. And it's beautiful, it's really so... And the ultimate stam is the word for Atika Kadisha, meaning the ultimacy. Atika Kadisha is the word in Aramaic for Hamukhlat, Hamakor. It's not Elohim. Elohim is a result. In the Kabbalah, Elohim is a consequence, is made by the source, Hamakor, or Hamukhlat, the ultimate, or the source. And it's called Atika Kadisha, the ancient, holy, ultimate consciousness, whatever you want to call it. And his name is Stam, the absolute Stam. This is lovely. Stima de Stimin. And seeing the world like that is liberation. If we want to ask what is Nibbana, it is the seeing of the world like that. It is not just seeing of the world, it is living like that. With that understanding deeply, with that understanding that is not able anymore to be undone. You can't go back just like the sutta that Sandhya read at the end of the sutta. For that purpose, I'm alive. And my purpose in life has been fulfilled because that is now my life. And it needs us to keep opening the view of what we see beyond the limited view of subject and object that apparently exist. Object seems to exist and subject seem to exist. We have to keep breaking that down and opening that box, those boxes. And it's all the time happening to us. And we've been practicing it here in together. And we're doing it, and I know that all of you, and we've had groups, and we're discussing, and I've been teaching hundreds of retreats, and we all on the journey have experiences that are unpleasant, maybe, that are difficult, that are problematic, things come up, we remember things, we're struggling with things, we have biographic issues, we have memory, we have tendencies that block us, all that stuff of the human being is there. But at the same time, it is actually what we're doing here. We are opening the view bit by bit by bit when we do walking meditation and we just open the question, what is walking? That's what we're doing. The question doesn't have an answer. The answer is in the doing of it. The answer is in the knowing that actually walking is a whole world. It's not just I'm walking to get to the shop to buy food. It is opening that closed place. And as we open more and more and more, we see the world like that more and more and more. Can we see the space in this room, not just the people? If we practice, yes. We're aware of space, and we're aware of people sitting in space. If we don't practice, we'll only see people. It's an absurd, crazy question to ask somebody. Can you look, can you see space in the room? It's stupid. They put you in a mental hospital, lock you up. But the view, opening the view, is also allowing things that are not so interesting. The Kotsim in Klil, the whole year they're not so interesting. To everybody says, we have to get rid of them. They're horrible. They prick you. I remember the early days in Klil, we had big fights because some of the early people in Klil came from a kibbutz childhood, and they wanted to cut all the kotzim and put desha. And we were really against and fighting this view and leave them be. They need to be there. That's their place. You know, why? We have to control everything and tidy up, make everything so tidy and sort it out. The sader everything with the desha. No, let the thorns be there. But the thorns are not interesting in a certain way. They're unpleasant. But yet look at the flower. Because of the kotsim, there is the flower. So we're not being selective and saying, that's not interesting, this is interesting. And this is our practice. And as we do that, we get less kind of attached to what is apparently interesting for us. Like this, the only thing is interesting is that it does its job. Instead of that, we open the view and we begin to see this object in its many, many dimensions and faces. And it's no longer an object that we just use. The view is opened all the time. So, as we practice, we become more interested in awareness. and less in objects of awareness. And mindfulness, the practice of awareness, helps us by being in the mode of witnessing, edut, to be always in the world of witnessing, more and more and more, we become less stuck on objects and more able to see, feel that we are present, that we are here, that we are knowing things. It's more right brain, left brain, there's a bigger brain. We're more using the mind, the whole mind, to be able to know the world. And not just a conceptual mind, but a bigger mind that is able to look at the world from a much bigger place. It's very alive. And we begin to become more familiar with what is consciousness. What is the awareness? What is it? What is the awareness that goes out and knows things? And the aggregates, the Mitzurfim, are about this. And we begin to realize that the awareness is just a function, a movement of knowing. It goes out and it gets stuck. And then we don't know that we know. We see an object and that's all we see. We don't see the knowing of the object. We just see the object. The knowing is just knowing. So it doesn't have any object in it. If I see male, female, female, male, female, 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 is the knower female or male? The knower isn't female, isn't male. The consciousness isn't male or female, but it is able to see male or female. Or consciousness isn't stick, it's able to see stick. Consciousness itself isn't stick. Consciousness isn't body. We know the body with the consciousness. But the consciousness isn't body. It just knows body. An interesting expression that I just found in the traditional text. I was just now in my room reading a little bit about, and one of the images, quite subtle image, one of the images of consciousness touching objects, for example body, nama rupa, is the consciousness touches an object and then turns back. It doesn't get stuck in an object and think that the knower and the known is the same thing. It turns back. It doesn't get stuck. Anyway, never mind all of that. maybe it's all too abstract. But what does happen as we're interested in awareness, the mind simply gets bigger. It just gets bigger. We just have more space in the mind. The big mind is spacious aware. It can include more. Like I was saying about the grain of salt in the cup or in the lake. It's the big mind opens the world. But in there, in this big mind, there is a lot of quiet. There is less friction. There is less struggle. There is less measuring, because it's inclusive. The struggle is, I like the flower of the kotsim, and not the kotzim. That struggle. I need to cut the kotzim because I want the flower, or I want the grass, I want desha. No struggle would say, there's flower. The flower is there, the kotzim are there, they need each other. There is the earth, there is the sun, there is the sky, there is the rain. All of that is making flowers. The flower is beautiful, the kotzim are unpleasant. I'll have it all. There is always there. There's less measuring, less busyness with the small mind. Small mind says, flower I want, I need, it's mine, I want to have it, I want to see it, I want to smell it. That's a small mind. It goes into the object very specifically. There's a text that talks about this, about the elements. And the text says, an ordinary person who looks with the ordinary small mind will see earth and say, oh, it's earth, this is earth, I need it or I don't need it, I like it, don't like it, I have it, I'm interested in it, it does this, it does that, I build on it, I use it, and so on. And an awakened mind or a big mind will recognize that earth is earth, but it stops there. It doesn't go into, I need it, my earth, I'm doing it, I'm busy with it, it's like this, it's like that. Just say, earth is earth. That's it. The small mind is busy with the word papancha, is the word meaning the proliferation or the wheels in the mind. What's the word for proliferation in Hebrew? Does it have one?
Pituach.
Rumination, yeah, rumination, but it's also, it's where everything in the mind makes its babies and makes its one thought invites its brothers and its sisters and its uncles and its aunts and its grandparents for the party. So, proliferation.
Proliferation is a little horror shop.
What?
Shop of little horror. There is some kind of חנות קטנה ומטריפה, שהיה שם כזה צמח שהלך וכל הזמן הלך וגדל וטרף הכל, וגדל וטרף. זה,
אוקיי, fair enough. And it's a tendency that we have in the small mind, because we're trying to understand the world, and we have needs, and we're busy with them, and this busyness, ha'isuk, of trying to understand the world, makes this thought and that thought and then this thought, rumination, as you say, ruminatia, and this and that, I need that and I don't that, and this is not good, and this and that, blah, 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 on and on and on and on. And it's painful. And we do it a lot with the me. And there's a sutta I'd like to read to you about this. If you're not paying attention, you will think, was I like that before? Or was I not like that before? What was I in the past? How was I yesterday? What was for me yesterday? Having been what did I become in the past because of what was there before? What shall I be in the future? What will happen to me? Or shall I not be? Maybe I won't be in the future. Maybe I'll die tomorrow. What shall I be? How shall I be in the future? What shall I become? Or am I? Now. In the present. Or am I not? What am I? How am I? Where am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? It goes on and on. I won't, many different versions of varieties of views about self and non-self, papancha. It's really very difficult and subtle. If we allow it, and if we get into it, these are endless. The endless views that we have as we try and understand the world from a small mind point of view. What is it? How is it? How can I use it? Is it good for me? Is it not good? Is it this? Is it that? What will it be? What will it, what has it been? How will it change? Etc., etc. Views, views about life, views about myself, views about politics, views about, ethics, views about other people, views about the neighbors, views about the enemies, views about identities, views about the world, views, endless, 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 endless views, attachments with a small mind that is stuck trying to sort the world out. So, we need to go in another direction. Our practice takes us in another direction, direction of a bigger mind, a freer mind that doesn't need all that stuff. But we can't pressure the mind to do that. And that's why we need to be friendly and kind to ourselves at the same time. We can't put ourselves under pressure in order to undo the mind. We have to do it in a human way, because the pressure makes more of the problem. Doesn't bring quiet. The mind isn't quiet with under pressure. So we need to do it without pressure. But interest in a bigger view, a freer way in which we look at objects in the world. Ourselves, the sky, the flower, the stick, the tree, the person. And it's a slow process, and it can be a long one. And it's not just on retreat. It's in our whole life. And the reason it's slow often is because we may have experiences on retreats which are really helpful in this. And we may actually feel, you know, in a few days we can feel a very expanded view. We can have a deeper view of reality. But the problem is that there's what's called anusaya. And the word anusaya is again a Pali word. It means tendencies, netiyot, that are built inside sankharas or structures, which are psychological structures that are quite deep and quite subtle, that they can sometimes hold us down and hold us back. And here we need really time and development to touch those places. Like I think of anusaya, I hear Goenka's voice saying, deep-seated sankharas. That's how he describes them. Deep-seated meaning, deep sankharas meaning, deep in the unconscious, in the subconscious, in the sitting there like the demons down in the bottom of the ocean. That's what he means. But in the more kind of, I think the better language for it is just tendencies, netiyot. And they take time to undo. And we use the mind to undo them. So we're using the mind to undo the mind. And an image I just want to share with you, an image from the suttas, is that we keep using the mind to undo the problems of the mind. It's like a carpenter that uses a small piece of wood to knock out a big piece. Same piece, a peg. I mean, in carpentry, you can use a peg to knock out another peg, a bigger peg. But use a small peg, like a little thing, to deal with a big thing. So we use small pegs, more subtle, more quiet, to deal with the big issues. We use mindfulness, which is more subtle, to deal with something which is more gas, more gross in the mind. So I want to address, finally, the whole issue of action in the world. Because it might seem that if we have this vision, if we have this sense of the total interrelation of things, the dynamic nature of self, which is like emptiness, but the dynamic nature of self. So what are we going to do? How can we talk if there's no self there? No self. I mean, the non-selfing. Who's talking? How does a word happen? How are we going to act in the world? Where do we find motivation? A lot of people say this. And how am I going to make money if there's no self there to desire money or to be ambitious? How do I act? How can I change things? How can I? So if we want to start with the issue of language. And the first thing is to see is that the Buddha didn't stop arguing with people. And you think, why? If he was in this state of total knowing, so why did he argue? How can he argue with anybody? Why wasn't he silent? Like the Zen flower. There's nothing to say anymore. The flower is made from all the parts of the world. A word is made from everything else. Nothing to say. And the answer is, and the Buddha talked about this himself, he was a muni. Muni is the word silent one, inside. He could argue with people outside and try and convince them maybe of the Dharma or explain to them the Dharma, but it didn't disturb the quiet inside. And he said, the Buddha said, I don't argue with the world. The world argues with me. It's really nice. I don't argue with the world. The world argues with me. I have nothing. I have no reason to argue with the world, but the world argues with me. Okay, so I respond. From my silent place, I respond. If you have no views, attached to views, it doesn't mean that you can't respond to others from that place of not having strong views. If someone tells you something painful, like you must be afraid of all Arabs. A view. All Arabs are against us. It's a view of now also not just Israel. It's a view. You can respond to that view from your big mind without pressure and with an inner silence, using speech and offering something else. You don't need to respond to that view, which is unwise. You don't need to respond from that view to enter an argument and be attached to your own view, which is opposite to that, which may be opposite to that. You're offering the big mind, that's all you can do. And that big mind says, you don't need to be attached to that view. Maybe it's not true. Maybe it's not right. And maybe it's not helpful. That particular view, maybe not helpful. Maybe causes suffering. And maybe it's not true. I'm offering that. That's using language to break a view, but it doesn't express another opposite view. It just opens a box, closed, somewhere closed. And I think language is like that. Language can be used knowing it's a convention, knowing it's limited, still used, without views, without attachment, without resistance, without friction, chikuch. You're offering language. No problem there, and the Buddha was doing it all his life. No problem there. Reminds me of a famous little story of Chuang Tzu, who said, I know that language just doesn't tell us the about reality. Show me the man that's given up words. I want to have a word with him. It's like the Diamond Sutta. Words don't do the job, that's why we have words. It's this dialogue between form and emptiness, between the relative and the ultimate. We know differences, but we don't build on them. The Buddha would know differences because otherwise how could he eat? How could he cross the road? Havchanot. We know them. We know that this is different from this, and therefore I can make a sound with this. I know that. The mind tells me that. But I don't need to be there believing that that is the whole story about these two objects. So, this big view doesn't lead to being a muni, silent, doesn't lead to passivity, non-action, withdrawal. It doesn't mean we have to go in a cave and run away from life, because life is relative. It doesn't mean to say we shouldn't heal ourselves or the world. The Buddha had a doctor. Why not? If you're sick, take a pill. Why not? There's no point in saying, oh, I see the whole universe, so why should I do anything now? No. You see the whole world and you take the pill. So what? And actually a bit more than that. Because in the answer to, so how do we act? What is our responsibility in, from this point of view, from this understanding? What's our responsibility? I think that our responsibility gets more subtle, more powerful. Because instead of pressure to change the world and pressure to find out what I have to do and to do it, the big mind of interconnection, of the way that everything is making everything else, that big mind will tell us what to do. It will tell us without concepts, without having to make lists of priorities. What I need to do is this, 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 this first. The interrelation is much more spontaneous. Action will come more spontaneously What is needed right now? This is what's needed. This is happening. From that big mind, we will know what to do. Responsibility is ability to respond. Yicholet lagiv. We're talking about what is our power to respond. Yicholet, our power. What tools do we use to respond to the needs of the world? And there cannot be a better tool that we need to respond to the world than a mind and a heart that is totally with the world, and therefore responding from the place of being completely with the world, and not just with my view. And from being with the world and not with the view, the response comes immediate and spontaneous and helpful, hopefully, and without wobbling, without I'm afraid, maybe yes, maybe no. It's just happening. What's needed, and then the response happens. Of course we make choices. We had a discussion in the service retreat, the Tzevet last night. We had quite a long discussion about the old story of being Tivoni, Tivonut, and whether there should be milk in the fridge of the retreat here or not. We had quite a long discussion about that last night, and quite an interesting discussion. But it's clear that we will respond according to the circumstance, what is needed for this person at this time. So for this person at this time, it may be really, really important to pay attention to the suffering of the animals the way we look after them. And that's fine. And if for this person at this time, that is what's needed. But for another person at this time, it should be something else. It may be something else. This person at this time feels the suffering of cancer patients and goes and helps them. And actually, the cows are not that interesting at that point for that person. I personally spent 20 years on peace work with Israelis and Palestinians maybe 18 years, something like that. And then I just felt I couldn't anymore. I just didn't have energy there. So I don't go personally now to all these events of peacemaking events. I support them very much, but I can't do everything. So I've chosen in a way to be more talking to people who are activists and teaching retreats and so on. And that's my contribution. That's what I feel is right for me. That's what I can do. That's what I can bring. So that's a decision. I can't do everything. So we decide what to do according to who we are, karma, the moment, what feels right. So we have to make choices, and that's fine. And what works for us, what feels right, what works. But the whole thing is spontaneous, is free, and is based on quietness, not on papancha. It's based on quietness. It's based on being without chikuch, with friction. The image of the bodhisattva is an image which is really important, coming from the Mahayana tradition. And bodhisattva is big mind and big heart. Sattva is subtle place, harmony. Big mind that brings harmony to the world. And the bodhisattva is the character of the bodhisattva. He can do, or she can do, so much because there's no self in there with views of how things should be done. And there's a beautiful text that says, the bodhisattva defines his or her role as bringing everybody and everyone to end suffering and awakening. Not only people, but also animals. And there's a beautiful text that says, if it happened that a bodhisattva would bring all beings to awakening and end suffering in the universe, and you ask him, wow, you did an amazing thing. He would say, who did it? And if you ask him, how did you do it? He would say, I did nothing. I did nothing. And it's a very different view from the view of the person and the papancha that comes with it. So from this may be hard to understand from a place where we're used to, we're conditioned to think that the only reason, the only thing that gets me up in the morning is my ambition and my drive to get things done and to achieve and the bottom line and measuring if I succeed or not succeed. And from that place, not so easy to see this other view. But if we just kind of go to the place of the big mind, the bigger mind, it will be possible to see it. And it's much more like a dance, that our life becomes a dance. And a dance is like the poet T.S. Eliot says, in the stillness is the dance. And the dance comes from that stillness, that still point. Is where the still point is from where the whole world is turning. And we dance with it if we're not in the world of the person. Then we just dance with the world, the dance of the world. It's just happening. Thank you.